This is a board meeting of Desert Community Energy, April 16th, 2018.
All three members are present.
I thought we voted Jeff off the island last time.
You did.
We actually did such a good job.
We did. She was telling me what to do on the phone just now.
Yeah, so okay, we're okay.
And Yvonne's not coming today.
Can I just bring up very quickly that I read that Yvonne is
stepping down,
and I believe Joe McKee is not running. Sorry, they need to maybe address that if they still have an interest in DCE.
I'll talk to the mayor about it.
Sometimes we lose the thread of communication, and they may not even be aware.
I'm sure that could occur in this case.
Yeah,
so.
That takes us to public comments, and I believe we have at least one.
We do. My name is Kim Floyd, and I'm a resident of Palm Desert. I have three things I want to mention quickly. First, I'm concerned about this process being accused of not being transparent. Now, you, as elected officials, know a hell of a lot more about that than I do. It just concerns me that so few people are relating to this process as something that's going to impact them, and that just concerns me. So I don't have an answer for it. The second thing I wanted to mention is and suggest that we want early access to the public benefits funds, which is, if I understand the calculation, it's a lot of money that goes into that fund, and it can either stay with Edison for some period of time, or we can try to get our hands on it sooner rather than later, and I'm just hoping that we get it sooner rather than later to use it locally, as you all would define. And the third thing I wanted to ask about was the possibility of contracting for geothermal energy. And I don't think it necessarily has anything to do with IID. I think it would have to do with the producers that are out there that may have energy available, and whether, you know, we would think of that as relatively high on our list to look at, not as a commitment. Thank you.
Good points. Any other public comments?
No.
We will move on to board member and director comments. I'm not seeing any. We'll move on to the consent calendar. Do I have a motion on the three items for consent?
Move approval.
Second, although I'm abstaining on the minutes.
Okay.
Item A.
We're abstaining on the minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No. So motion carries. That takes us to item six. We'll start with an update on our progress.
Yeah, we did provide a written report on progress. Not much has changed since we sent this agenda out on Friday, but just to verbally go over this, and Katie could fill in the blanks. You remember we were stalled in many ways related to the 2018 resource adequacy issue. We have reached an agreement with Edison on terms that have been woven into our rate structure and certainly our perform up. We do have some paperwork to finish with Edison by, I think it's, what is it, May 17th? Mm-hmm. We have to send in an advice letter jointly with Edison to the PUC that identifies the terms that we have reached with Edison over the 2018 RA. Edison will take the lead on that, and we're working with BB&K in particular on some of those details. I don't see any hiccup there. Edison's been very professional working with them on these terms, so we expect that to be complete in the next couple of weeks. On the PCIA matter, you'll see a just short report there. We haven't been directly engaged in this, but CalCCA has been. and have hired experts, legal experts and technical experts to defend CCA's positions up and down the state. And I think they have been fairly effective making key points in those determinations. We have a list of items next, and budget and staffing. Just as a reminder, you're contracting with CVAG to provide staff support. As the chair knows, because he sat in on CVAG's admin personnel committee a couple weeks ago, we're going to weave into the budget two positions at CVAG to support your operations. And but putting them into the CVAG budget does not imply that they've been approved by this board. What will happen is the CVAG budget is drafted and prepared, and at the next meeting, you will actually approve a budget for next fiscal year, which may or may not include personnel positions, depending on your preferences. What I could tell you is we're busting at the seams with Katie doing a whole lot of work for three organizations right now. And so we will try to make the case that we'll need a couple of positions. But again, our aim in the early years is to have a bare bones of operation as possible and really stick savings back into your ratepayers' pocketbooks, as well as develop a reserve, which is your priority. The other item on the agenda, and somewhat relates to Kim's point, is you've mentioned the desire to have a community advisory committee. We haven't taken steps to do so, but we'd expect at one of the next two board meetings to come up with some ideas for your consideration. Katie, did I forget anything?
That's good.
All right.
And
any questions?
I want to commend you and Katie and Benjamin and the rest of the group for all the work that's been going on behind the scenes in order to get us to this point, and particularly the conversations with Southern California Edison as to the RA agreement.
Thank you. And I think we are the first and perhaps the only one in the state now to have a deal in the 2018 RA with at least Edison, if not PG&E.
I think a few small, the city of King City, there were a couple of others, but much smaller. I believe that's correct.
So, I think that'll be successful. If it isn't, I'll let you know right away.
Okay. I got a little ahead of myself as we did the consent agenda, because I realized I had made a couple of notes for myself that I forgot. So let me go back just for a second, just from an informational perspective. I know that we indicated our retention program. I just wanted to make sure that if we had any publication materials, that we were maintaining copies of those, sample copies of those, for historical purposes, not for record keeping. I'm assuming that would be a normal process going forward. I had another comment on cybersecurity, but I'm going to hold on that. And then we obviously agreed on the Cal CCA. It's an expensive undertaking.
It is.
And I'm wondering if you might want to consider evaluating that on a six-month basis to make sure that that makes sense going forward.
It's funny, because I was coming back to that. I had that highlighted for that very reason. I forgot to mention that. I do think, you know, it's beyond a $5,000-$10,000 a year membership, estimated $83,000, I think, the first year, and as much as $143,000 the second year. So I think a cost-benefit analysis is warranted there.
Yeah, I half was expecting that item to be pulled because of the expense, and it would be inappropriate to talk about it now and bring it up. It is expensive, and curiously enough, Cal CCA has a staff of one. So this is not paying for internal costs of some large organization. This is paying for technical experts, legal experts, and the like to testify on all of our behalf.
Yeah.
Given the chairman's seen this firsthand, if not all of you have, the testimony is incredibly detailed, and involvement in the PUC is complex, to say the least.
Yeah.
I certainly would have said this before your consideration, but I strongly advise that we continue to be engaged there. They're doing some rolling for all of us, and it saves us from having a regulatory person on staff and substantial savings, in my opinion. And what we'll do is put this we don't really, I don't know if their budget is an annual one on a fiscal year.
They do make an adjustment on an annual basis. From what I understand, we need to, this is a fairly recent update of their fees.
If it's okay with the board, why don't we find the right time to make that assessment? If they make some kind of annual assessment, if it's December, if you could give me a little bit of latitude, we will do a more detailed assessment of the services they provide and do a cost-benefit analysis of it at that time.
Well, and I would think they would actually be able to produce a report of what they've done during the year and how successful they've been. So
yes, they're one employee, you could.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Not to debate the issue because we're passive, but my thinking was we certainly need to be a part of this in our first year.
Yeah,
but if we're going to pay $150,000 a year after that, then there may be other alternatives for promoting our agenda.
Yeah.
I mean, you can pretty much hire your own full-time person potentially for that kind of money. You could be working for you nonstop or joining another one and split the time. So I'm just saying, in my mind, the reason I said yeah is because this first year out, $83,000 absolutely, but thereafter, maybe there is a greater scrutiny.
That was my sense, too.
Okay. And we'll do.
Since we're talking about this, which I was just mentioning to you later, but they have us on there on their website, but going to San Francisco. So they should fix the link on that. Just we're already on their website as a member.
And it links
to San Francisco.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Thanks for checking.
Yeah, I was looking at, because you know a lot of the major ones are members, but I don't know if it did.
We better travel to San Francisco in August to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good one.
It is.
Bring your ski jacket.
Maybe they were part of
the CJCC.
Maybe that's
that.
I don't know.
The coldest place.
Okay. If there's no other discussion on that, let's go on to 6B, and I believe we have public comment on this. So. Ken, would you like to?
Oh, 6B is
yes.
Great. Yes. Looking at the rate schedule, I think the question is going to come up pretty quickly. Why are you doing this? Why would you engage? This is in the first year, the rates that are in this schedule. And I understand some of the nuances, and I happen to favor clean energy, but I think there are a large group of players out there that will denigrate decisions based on clean energy. And I'm just hoping that we will be prepared with something other than the Sierra Club likes clean energy, so we thought we'd do that. That's my concern.
That will be part of our marketing material. Thanks.
Can I just address the speaker?
Sure.
Part of the thinking was to provide consumers with choice, which they don't currently have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we're necessarily promoting, and certainly not mandating, clean energy, but giving our residents an opportunity to make that choice. Do you think that message would resonate based on your comments with the people that perhaps have those concerns?
I'm getting this from watching what happened in Murrieta at their city council meeting. There are going to be a set of people, I think just stay away from green, stay away from clean, stay on local decision making, bringing investments to the local community, the other things.
Okay.
That's all.
Thank you.
Okay. And for what it's worth, the speaker is referring to actions in Western Riverside County, and there's a group, Foothill Taxpayer Group, that is concerned that, I think they're among their issues, kind of an Agenda 21 concern about government getting into bigger issues.
The United Nations getting into.
Yeah.
Yes. So far, they haven't. I don't think they've made it to Palm Springs yet.
They made it to me.
Okay.
They did.
They've probably run out of Palm Springs.
No, they skipped us.
Brian, were they just asking?
They were asking during the public hearings on the JPA at the city council, just for information. I talked to a gal twice.
Is that Rosario?
I don't think it was.
And there was for staff reports and sample agreements. But I believe it's the same group that made it to Sandbag or WR Cog CCA hearing, which is on YouTube if you want to get a sample of what their message is.
Mm-hmm. Good to know.
Okay, on 6B, Katie, are you going to
pick Actually, Jeff is going to give this presentation.
Okay, there you go.
Well, thank you. So the presentation is actually a combined presentation that covers both rates and procurement, but I think these are actually two separate agenda items.
Yep.
So we'll pause them there after the rates. And before I get too far down the road, I do have two of my colleagues on the telephone. John Putz, who's one of our most senior analysts, is on, and he was the architect of the rates work, so he's available to answer any technical questions that may come up. And then I also have Marty Parsons on the phone. Marty heads up our procurement group, so when we get to the next part of the or the next agenda item, he can speak to that as well. So as far as an overview, and again, I've got the two agenda items combined on here, but the rate overview, just a real quick review of the product offerings, rates, and then I do have an updated financial projection as well that I'll hand out in a minute, just because the rates are obviously intended to collect the revenues to meet the cost of the organization. And then we'll get into the procurement strategy. We're not quite ready to go out and do procurement, but it'll probably happen before the next board meeting. So I want to just provide some background and context and let you know what we're planning to do there. So on the rate setting, again, just as a reminder, we're going to have the two products, the default product that'll be a 35% renewable, 50% carbon-free or GHG-free, 100% carbon-free for the balance of the portfolio, which will be an opt-up option. So customers that elect to not opt out of the program will automatically be enrolled into the default product, and then they'll also have the option of opting up to the 100% carbon-free product. The other thing I'll spend some time talking about is net energy metering and what we're proposing there as far as a program right out of the chute. And the other thing we're planning to do as far as rate classes go, and really just simplicity, and this is something that all CCAs have done at launch, and I'm not sure any of them have even moved off of this yet, is just the plan is to mirror all of the SCE rate schedules and just have a corresponding one, just really for understanding, ease of transition, and the like.
Be able to do an apples-to-apples comparison.
Exactly, just a straight-up comparison here. So as far as the base portfolio composition goes, as I said, it'll be 35% renewable, 50% GHG-free or carbon-free. The pie chart just gives you kind of a rough breakdown on the different components of the power supply. And in that renewable, 22% will be in-state, or what gets referred to as PCC1 or Bucket 1 RECs. That's the state requirement, the minimum state requirement. And then the balance of the renewable portfolio will be comprised of out-of-state renewable generation. And then the 50% GHG, that balance of 15%, will be large hydro purchases. So as we've said, the plan, and as you approved last month, that the base product or the default product, we had set the initial rates at 3% below the comparable SCE generation rates. I've got a couple of slides here that'll just show you how we're actually calculating that. And that's, I think there's actually a detailed rate schedule in the board packet for each of those. And then the plan is for the 100% carbon-free rate is to actually just have the SCE default rate be the price for that product. So just be able to go straight across at the same rate that SCE is currently charging folks.
Jeff, on the financials, are you going to indicate what that looks like from a financial perspective?
We can. It's not really baked in directly at this time in the financials because it's designed to be largely revenue neutral. And so what we'll end up doing when we do the initial procurement, we'll procure to meet the default supply portfolio requirements. And then after we see how many folks sign up for the premium product, we can go out and make some incremental purchases to be able to do that. But the rate design is intended to be cost neutral, revenue neutral from the CCA's perspective. So There's a lot of numbers on this table, and I apologize. I got several tables in here that have lots of numbers on them and stuff. But what this is intended to do here is just for a typical residential bill, and we've simplified the bill a little bit, but really hit on the main line items or cost components of the bill. And then the next slide will do for a typical commercial customer. But does this pointer work? Guess not. Stand up here.
Can you do it on here?
So we've got for a summer view of the bill, and then a winter bill, but they're essentially the same. So the intent here, we've got kilowatt hour usage. We've got what they would currently pay as an SCE customer, then what they would pay as a Desert Community Energy default customer, and then the premium product or the 100% opt-out. And in each case, as we show the dollar per kilowatt hour or the rate, and then what the total charges are going across. And you'll see here is if you look at the transmission and distribution, there's no change in those across the board. Those carry forward across the board in all scenarios, and that's consistent with the CCA, the investor-owned utility. In your case, Edison retains responsibility for all those transmission distribution charges, so there's no changes there. Where the changes come in is in the generation charge, which is this is the rate that DCE will set to assess your customers, and then the exit fees. And we've labeled this exit fees. There's actually also the franchise fee that's buried in this as well, but it's predominantly the exit fee is the big driver. So when we talk about the 3% rate discount here, what we're doing is we're comparing the sum of the generation plus exit fees for DCE to what the SCE generation rate is. Now, if you go through and do the math, there's some rounding, so it doesn't always round to exactly 3%, but that's the intent of what we're doing here. And so then when we get to the premium product out here off to the side, you'll see that your generation rate is actually different than SCE's generation rate, but when you sum the generation rate plus the exit fee that they will pay, the sum of those two is equivalent to the SCE generation rate. I don't know if there's any questions. That's the residential look, and then the next slide does a similar analysis for a commercial customer.
So the overall saving to the consumer in the default is more like 2%.
On a total bill.
On a total
type
bill.
Base. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Again, I think that goes back to Mr. Floyd's comments in terms of how you market it, because obviously local control is a big issue, and while there is some savings, it's not a huge savings associated with it, certainly with residential. And this is obviously just a sample bill, but I'm assuming it just translates into
correct. Else. Yeah, the intent here was to show you, make sure everybody understood the arithmetic and how we were applying it again in the board packet or the agenda packet. I guess there's a resolution too. We've actually gone through and done the math on all of those generation rates.
The commercial bill, your 15,000 kilowatt hour usage, what size commercial are we talking about in that? Is there any sense of...
I don't know. John, do you know off the top of your head what that is?
I'm sorry, can you repeat? It's a little hard to hear.
Yeah, the question, John, is for the commercial bill and the 15,000 summer usage kilowatt hours a month, what size? Is that a small, medium, large size commercial? I don't think it's a small, but...
I don't know. I mean, that's it's driven by, kind of your peak demand. So... It could be any, I suppose, but I'm not sure exactly where the example came from.
Okay. Well, I can look and follow up on that one.
It's going to be a larger business. I mean,
yeah.
Probably just based on our experience, 15,000.
Yeah, it's pretty good size.
Pretty good size office or maybe a modest retail establishment.
Yeah.
So a manufacturing. But it's not your small 2-3
Yeah, it's not like a small store or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, this is certainly illuminating. I mean, I think when we circle back to the marketing aspect, this highlights that if this is promoted to the public as a cost-saving measure, it'll certainly backfire because the savings, as we knew all along, are so modest. So from a marketing standpoint, and really our reasons have to focus on the other benefits and the other reasons for going in this direction. And I'm not sure that the ability to go green should be overly understated. I think that will appeal to a lot of people. As long as one says that it's a choice, that it's not a mandate.
And what's central to driving is profit.
Exactly.
That's the central part.
Yeah.
Local control.
Are you going to address net energy meter?
I am. Are we ready to?
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing, obviously, that everybody's interested in is net energy metering. This slide here just provides you with a total breakdown. So there's a little under 8,800 net energy metering customers in the three-city area. Most of those are residential, about 8,600. You can see the breakdown here. The one piece of the analysis, and I'll get to the implications of this here in just a minute, that we're still trying to finalize with SCE is the number of net surplus generators, so that over the course of a 12-month period, we're actually generating more electricity and putting more electricity onto the grid than they're consuming. We've got a couple of data files, and we're trying to confirm exactly with SCE how to interpret that. So there is one implication of that, but we're still ready to recommend the proposal or the program to you here, which I'll get to here in just a minute. So I wanted to take a minute here just to put together an illustration just so you can see what the different choices are with net energy metering. And there's a lot of data on this slide. This is my second of the two slides. Again, I apologize for having all the information, but I think it's helpful to understand what the different choices are and decisions are. The other thing I will say on this chart is, particularly for like residential customers and in the kilowatt hour usage columns, there's actually a breakdown here that you showing the usage and the generation separate that oftentimes doesn't exist. There's just a single meter that's netting the meter. But for illustrative purposes, I wanted to break it out. So again, I'll stand up here. And John and Marty, I apologize if you can't hear me on the phone. So the way this is showing over a 12-month period here. The first tranche of columns here is showing the kilowatt hour usage, so the actual usage, and this is intended to be for a residential customer here.
That's but, total usage?
Yeah, what the total usage would be, what the generation would be, and then what the net would be over the course of the year and on a monthly basis. So anytime you see a positive value, that means the generator was a net consumer. If you see a negative value, it means they were a net generator, or they generated more kilowatt hours than they actually produced. Here's retail rates, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. And then here's just doing the arithmetic of the rate times the quantity to break it all out. So, and we did try to, the rates here are consistent with the rate schedule. It's actually an average of the TOU D, A, and B schedules, I think, if I remember correctly.
Just going to ask
that. Yeah, that we put in here. So you won't see it exactly, but if you look at the two rate schedules and just take a simple average, that's what they should be here. But really, the kind of the points are more important than the numbers here. So one thing that's common to all NEM programs, whether it's CCAs or investor-owned utilities, everybody is crediting the monthly generation at the retail rate, and then allowing those generation credits to accumulate and offset charges in subsequent months over the course of a year. So that's common to all programs, and that's a part of your program as well that we're recommending. One optional thing that some CCAs, particularly in Northern California, I don't think any in Southern California have done, and even the more recent Northern California utilities have started, or CCAs have started to move away from, is they were offering a generation premium, if you will, an additional penny credit on top of the retail rate when they were going through and doing the arithmetic on what the generation credit would be over the course of the month. Where the programs begin to differ is in how things are trued up over the course of a year. Some CCAs are looking at the dollar credits over the course of the year. Some CCAs, and actually Edison, and what we're recommending here is that you look at the net generation over the course of the year. So, and I've got a comparative slide here in just a minute, but some CCAs, what they will do is they'll go through and do all the math, what the usage was, what the generation was. If they have this adder here, they'll apply that, and then they just, every month they'll go along, and if there was a net charge, you paid it. If there was a net credit, you got the credit applied to your bill up to the point that you owed net zero, but then you never received money back on a monthly basis. But then over the course of the year, some of the CCAs were paying out the accumulated credits over the course of the full year. So in this example, this particular NEM customer was actually a net consumer. They generated less than they produced, but because of the value of the energy at the time it was produced versus the cost of the energy at the time that they bought, they still accumulated a net credit. And some CCAs have been paying that out. And again, the next slide's a summary one, and I'll show that. What Edison, though,
that's
is...
a lot more than Edison does.
Yeah, exactly. Edison does not do that. None of the IOUs do that. What Edison does, and what the IOUs do, and actually what we're recommending for DCE, and all Southern California CCAs to this point are doing the same thing, is at the end of the year, once you've applied all the credits to your bill, or to charges for current months, you can't actually get money back based solely on that. What happens is they actually switch over to the kilowatt hour side and ask, were you a net consumer or a net generator over the course of the year? In this case, they were a net consumer, so they would not get an annual credit. This would just all zero out, so they still wouldn't owe anything over the course of the year, but they wouldn't actually get the $498 back because they were a net consumer. If, however, they were a net producer or a net generator and this were a negative value, then you would get the value of the kilowatt hours at some rate. In DCE's case, we're proposing that rate credit be 6 cents per kilowatt hour. In Edison's case, they're actually doing it based off of a rolling 12-month historical look back that's currently about 3 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's a lot of information.
So, first question this raises is, and I'm not sure how we're structured to do this, but obviously right now anyone who's on solar has a true-up at the end of a 12-month period. Are we planning on bringing them into the system at their true-up time?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, one thing we still need to wrestle with is do we do that? Do we try to find... You basically have two choices. I guess you have three choices, but I think there's two that are from an administrative perspective, most practical. Most CCAs have fallen into one of two buckets, and this is another data item we need to confirm. Either A, if most of the NEM customers are truing up at approximately the same time, going ahead and bringing them all in at once, but maybe that wouldn't be on August 1, you would do it at another time when the true-up would be closer to zero, or would be less of an impact to avoid this kind of a thing. The other thing that CCAs are doing is if it looks like the true-ups are occurring kind of scattered throughout the year, is on a quarterly basis, enrolling chunks of NEM customers, again, with the objective of trying to minimize any negative rate impacts to them. But that's one other thing we're still trying to figure out.
Yeah, I ask a question?
Sure.
If a NEM customer adds at least their solar, who exercises the decision as to whether to stay in the CCA?
So my understanding is it still stays with the customer, and Katie, correct
That's
me if you're wrong, it still stays with the customer, and they're unaffected by this decision, either to stay a bundled customer or switch to the CCA. But it's the customer's decision, not the leaseor. That's the right. Because and that question has come up. You can confirm that, Keith. I think that's right.
Other questions?
I have a question. We have customers who receive who work with Grid Alternatives, and which provides free installation of solar, but they're required to work with Edison. They have to work because Edison's providing the program. Essentially, they're underwriting it. So these customers, it's our impression, would have to opt out in order to continue in the program to receive that free solar. Is that something that's been addressed before, that maybe there's a workaround, or...
I'm not familiar with them, so we'll have to look into that one.
We can check on it, Jay. We have Grid, of course, is active in the desert in a number of communities, they are working with a number of the CCAs, so I'll check and see what the basis of that is.
Yeah, they're doing single-family, and they're moving into a multifamily now.
Right, they have a new program on multifamily.
Yeah, that's
the first time I've heard.
Okay.
So, Jeff, to recap, what you, if you approve this policy, you're going to be offering those with solar a better deal than they currently are getting.
Yep.
There will be an impact on the budget. Mm-hmm. We don't know what that is because we haven't gotten the data yet. Will relate to probably your next board. On your next board packet, we'll give you an understanding of the implications of this. Because there will be essentially a cross subsidy, a lot of one, but a cross subsidy going on. Is that fair, Jeff?
Yes.
Can you clarify what you just said, or summarize it? In what way are consumers getting a better deal?
Those with solar on their roof, if you produce surplus during the course of the year, you get paid by Edison 3 cents per kilowatt hour. They sign up with, or they default to this CCA, they'll get paid 6 cents. And presumably, for those considering solar, there'll be more additional incentive to overbuild, to want to do solar and to overbuild on your roof.
Correct. That's right. So I heard that in some cases there's not a payment, that they just simply don't pay anything when you true up at the end of the year.
Yeah, it was complicated. No, it'll be under Edison as well as DCE's proposed approach. If at the end of the year you're a consumer of electricity, even though you have a consumer of Edison electricity or DCE electricity, you don't get paid by DCE or Edison.
Right.
If you are a net contributor to the system, you get paid in either circumstance.
You do.
Based on annual.
And then is that a physical payment or is that a credit?
It can be either one. I mean, the way it is now, I'm assuming it would probably still be.
And what's being suggested is, as we go along, that the production be credited at 6 cents or just the overage or just in general?
We would follow the Edison model and pay 6 cents for those that... generate more than they consume.
And why?
As an incentive for rooftop solar.
Okay. And is there that's a policy issue that again cuts to why have a DCE?
Yes.
But is there a way to prevent abuse, such as somebody creating a solar farm?
And this is what Jeff will bring back, whether perhaps. In addition to having a net energy metering policy, you may have a cap per customer on how much can be credited back, so that we can have some safeguards on the program. Your option, you don't have to have a net energy metering program at all. Mm-hmm. It could be a disadvantage for solar customers to come into DC. You could mirror Edison's, or you could do something better. We are suggesting you do something better. And when among the thousand other things we have TEA looking at, we looked at this 6 months ago, Jeff and I did, and it looked like it would be a relatively modest impact on your budget. And that's what we're going to give you more information on at your next board meeting.
So, you know, when we look at the fact there's about 9,000 solar customers out there, we don't know yet, we haven't gotten the information yet as to how many are actually generating through the end of the year versus how many are actually using.
Correct.
And then there's changes. I just added a third set of solars to the roof last fall, so...
So we'll make sure the chairman...
last year I paid $1,000 for electricity, so this year I may not pay anything, but I don't know that yet. It's too early.
What I also, when we come back to you, what we'd recommend is you approve the rate schedule and any a net energy metering program. Some of those details will work out next month. One of the things I'd recommend TEA and Jeff provide is maybe a implication of one of the policy questions we consider is why give the existing customers, except for the chairman, of course, any benefit at all? Or not, unless, although some of them might be adding solar. We're not incentivizing, they've already done it. Why give them the benefit of 6 cents? And maybe this should be targeted towards
new customers
or expansion.
Yeah.
So it's some of the policy implications.
And to Jeff's comment, the concept of actually paying on a monthly basis doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me, that you really want to do it at the true-up at the end of the year. And then I presume focusing in on kilowatt hours versus what the dollar savings look like as it progresses during the year. So
exactly,
I think there's a whole series of those questions that need to be finalized.
And we apologize for not having all of the answers. I think you appreciate how much data we're going through to get up to speed.
Yeah.
And to the point of, unfortunately, you gave us and the team a little bit more time by starting on August 1st. With this one, you're approving a program, the details of which will give you some more information at your next meeting for your consideration.
Although you're seeking approval of the actual rate structure.
Yeah, and part of the logic there, we don't have to necessarily provide a lot of details, but we're going to be, as Erica will point out, we're going to be putting information out to the community on what's going on, and solar customers in particular are going to be interested in
what's happening.
Do I still get benefit?
Tell me what's wrong with this perspective. That it would be imprudent to approve a specific rate structure without knowing the impact on the financial operations of the DCE.
What you could do, and I assume what you're talking about is rate structure for the NEM program.
Yes.
We really need you to approve the rate structure for the rest of the rate structure. On the NEM, Jeff and Katie and the rest of the team, would it be okay to approve having a NEM program that will at least match Edison's rate so that when customers call us in the next 30 days, that you're guaranteeing that there's not going to be a disbenefit to those customers?
Right.
We'll have more information in 30 days. Is that acceptable,
yes,
Jeff?
Yes.
We can make that.
That's absolutely prudent.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds good.
So we'll correct the staff recommend or modify the staff recommendation. You're approving a net energy metering policy and the details of which will be brought back to the next meeting. And that policy will be at least as beneficial to the customers as Edison's current program.
You can't really say you're going to approve something, details to be brought back.
Well, no, he's suggesting that we're approving it, that it's going to at least meet people.
I heard that part works.
I think you understand the intent. If customers call in, by approving a policy, we could say there will be no disbenefit to you.
Right. It will be at least as good as you're presently getting with Southern Gilbert.
And then what I'm sensing is that if there's not an adverse impact on the financials, then we may go to 6%, 6 cents rather than 3 cents.
Well, and I like Tom's comment. I mean, for those of us who already have solar on the roof, you know, we know what we're getting. Yeah. Why would we get any more? But to encourage someone to put solar on the roof might make it worthwhile to increase the amount. So
it does, but we also have to take into consideration, since we want to sell this to the larger community, what the reaction might be from those that already have it that might feel like, whoa, why should I go
right now? I'm thinking like the early adopters who spent more, the same amount of solar, would sort of feel like, okay, this message is don't do this.
Maybe worthwhile just make everybody happy.
There are all sorts of implications, certainly.
Yeah.
But exactly. At least we put them all on the table for your consideration.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that really takes us to a recommendation on the approval.
Doesn't matter to me.
Can we just talk about the marketing?
Oh, so
for the revised
item 2.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion carries. Passes. That will move us on to the power procurement presentation.
And, just to make a note, some of this information, we just got some of these tables in the last week, the staff in the last day as well. We'll do a better job of making copies available for everybody in the room that you could see. I can't see all of you.
We can send this around.
Or maybe we'll get iPads for the board or something else of it and make sure that everybody can see the information.
Binocular glasses.
Jeff?
Do you have anything on this? Or you want me to just...
No, go ahead.
Okay. So this one's just an information item. As I said, we're getting close to wanting to do the procurement. I think the last thing that needs to be done is just finalizing getting all the lockbox and all of that deposit control stuff all set up, and we're really close. It should be good to go. So I think before we meet again in May, it'll be done. So I wanted to provide a little bit of context and overview. So how we approach this, we very much think about this in a portfolio management kind of a context. And it kind of flows from left to right here on this, where it begins with the program objectives that you all approve. You know, you're talking about it right now just in the context of NEM, but you're laying out what are the environmental goals and objectives, what are the financial goals and objectives, rate savings, reserve building, those types of things. One of then the next steps that we'll come back to you next month with is an energy risk management policy. That's the ERMP. This is something that the board would approve, but this really lays out the framework for particularly on a short-term basis. It doesn't govern long-term contracts, which I'll get to here in just a minute, but kind of over the next 2 to 3, 4, 5 year kind of a time period, how you are going to interact with the market. And one key piece of this is it will set up a risk management committee. And there's it's the committee word here in the context of the Brown Act has been interesting. I will say different CCAs have interpreted that committee differently with respect to whether it's subject to the Brown Act, and the traditional municipal clients that we work with in other contexts have had similar differing interpretations about whether it's a Brown Act committee or not. But anyway, it would form a risk management committee. Typically, what you would see on that, you'd see like people like Tom and Katie, a financial officer type, TEA would be on this as well. And this is the group that's really charged with, on a day-to-day basis, if you will, overseeing the procurement strategy, administering it, making sure goals and objectives are being met. The other thing that will be laid out in the risk policy is specific limits that we're trying to achieve as far as how much surplus or short the CCA could be at a particular point in time. Again, as I said, what the financial goals and objectives are. Another key piece of the energy risk management policy is this is what will lay out a delegation of authority. So what term of transaction, volume of transactions would be delegated down to Tom, presumably, or maybe even if there were a program manager or something like that hired at some point, what their authorities would be versus when a procurement decision would need to come back to the board for authorization. Then you get into the actual procurement strategy. This is the game plan, the rules of engagement, if you will, for how we're going to actually interact with the market. And then we put in place a variety of metrics and reports just to track how we're doing performance-wise and are we meeting the goals and objectives of the program. When we talk about...
Jeff, before you leave that, mm-hmm. so... from a strategy standpoint, some of that would determine the length of general contracts you'd be looking for different types of
yes.
energy sources, and how much would be spot market and things like that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to what we're proposing to do here initially, but that's exactly what this is getting at. So when we think about procurement, we break it down into a couple of different time bins. One is long-term, and this is like the comment earlier about geothermal, or going out and doing a long-term PPA, whether it's geothermal or solar or wind or some other resource that's linked to a specific physical generating asset that's somewhere out there on the grid. That, you know, that's a long-term type of a contract. And the plan, at least initially, is to not include those on day one. The expectation is, you know, in time here over the next few years, that we will start to add those to the portfolio, but that those contracts would not be part of the initial procurement. The initial procurement would really be focused on kind of what we're referring to in this chart here under the forward procurement, or, you know, anywhere from as short as 1 month out to 5 years, and trying to layer in transactions over time with really the goal of getting the CCA, getting DCE up and running in a cost-effective manner, but also, too, in a low-risk manner as well, and get up and moving. And in the forward market, there is a fairly liquid market for energy and renewable energy credits and carbon-free energy out there in this forward time period here, and I'll get to that in a little bit. Then the next piece of this is the day-ahead market, and this is really the California Independent System Operator, or CAISO. CAISO really has two markets, if you will. You can kind of think of it as a next-day market, which is that day-ahead market or the spot market, and then there's a real-time market, and when you get down into it, there's actually 15 minutes and 5-minute markets and all this other kind of stuff going on, but this is really where all the imbalance energy, if you're load is running a little bit higher or less than what we had forecast it would be, or if a generator is producing a little bit more, underperforming relative to expectations, it's that real-time market where those differences get settled out here. The other thing before I dive into this specific strategy, how we think of procurement is you can break it into there's voluntary aspects to the procurement and there's mandatory aspects of the procurement. And when I say mandated, it's really from a state requirement perspective, not necessarily the requirements that you as a board impose on DCE. So on a mandatory basis, you have to participate in the California Independent System Operator market. They are the grid operator. They operate, again, a day-ahead market and a real-time market. You have to participate in those markets. There's a resource adequacy market. This is really on a forward basis, principally on a calendar year type of a basis for a planning cycle. And you're familiar with this through all the work with Edison. This is really contracting for capacity, steel in the ground, if you will, out there somewhere on the grid that has the potential to produce electricity. And this is really trying to avoid, this was an outgrowth of the energy crisis back in 2000, 2001, where the whole region found itself short, and just trying to make sure we don't find ourselves in a similar situation in the future. There's the renewable portfolio requirement. So right now, the state is moving towards a 33% retail sales have to be from renewable sources by 2020, eventually getting to 50% by 2030, and it's just a linear extrapolation between all those 2 points. Within each of those, or then within the renewable portfolio requirement, it's not up here on the slide, but as of right now, in the current compliance period, which is 2017 through 2020, 75% of that renewable energy has to be from in-state resources. The state does still allow 10% to be just unbundled renewable energy credits, but I don't think anybody's using those really anymore. I think there's some legacy stuff out there, but nobody's really using that anymore. So the 75% would have to come from in-state, and then the balance would be bucket two, or out-of-state renewable energy that's stored and shaped and redelivered at a later time. So those are all mandatory aspects to this. One of the other requirements that'll be out there beginning in 2021 is 65% of the RPS requirement will need to be contracted for on a 10-year or longer basis. So again, back to the geothermal, we don't have to do that today, but as we get closer to 2021, a portion of the renewable supply will need to be under long-term contract. And then there's also a storage requirement that's out there, again, not on day one, but by 2020, DCE will have to have 1% of its 2020 peak under contract in a storage type of resource, a battery or something like that, that would have to be online by 2024. So that's about 4 to 5 megawatts for DCE. So those are all mandatory things that either on day one or as we move forward in time will have to be part of your portfolio. Then there's the voluntary aspects of it. Part of that is hedging for risk management. So just going out and entering into fixed price block contracts of energy to manage price risk, bring cost certainty so you can set rates with confidence. The renewable requirement above and beyond the RPS requirement. So you've set a goal right now of 35%. I forget the exact percentage this year. I think it's 29% in 2018, if I remember correctly. That's actually part of the state mandate. So you're going a little bit above and beyond that. Also, too, the GHG-free or carbon-free energy, that's another voluntary aspect of it that most CCAs do, but it is a voluntary aspect of it. And then, again, local generation. So there won't be any on day one, but as we move forward in time, that can become part of the portfolio as well.
Jeff, can I ask you on that point so I don't forget? The 35%, I think you said the state mandate by 2020 is going to 50%?
No, it's 33% by 2020 and then 50% by 2030.
Does our policy, or will it be modified later? I assume we'll want our basic opt-out to be at that level or higher as it is now.
Yeah.
Have we already built that in, or that's
yes.
Something we'll address later?
Yeah, that's actually, we've got, so as a policy, it's not built in. In the pro formas, though, right now, we do have it stepping up in time so that you stay a little bit ahead of Edison and how they're projected to meet that requirement.
We anticipate doing that, but we haven't adopted that as formal policy.
Correct.
Yet. Is there any reason to address that now, given that we know that there's increases coming up, or is it better left to future boards to make that decision?
I guess it's a great...
The reason I ask is because that's been asked of me. It's like, why should we do this? The state's heading that way anyway.
Yeah. It's a great question. I guess as a matter of policy, my initial reaction is to maintain flexibility and to not tie your hands at this point. But certainly, I mean, I think as far as setting out a goal or an objective to continue to be ahead of that, I think that makes good sense.
Thank you.
So, yeah. You're going to find that, one, I'm very risk-averse, and two, anytime I want flexibility. So, as I said, our plan, again, in this, I'm going to now shift gears and really talk about procurement here over the next 1 to 2 years, so much, you know, shorter-term type of procurement. There is a liquid market out there. There's it's called the Intercontinental Exchange. You can kind of think of it as the stock exchange for electricity, if you will. It actually has a variety of energy products, so crude oil, natural gas, those types of things are also traded on it as well. But there is a liquid market. Inside the state of California, the state is largely broken up into three. I mean, you guys have probably heard there's like 3,000 different pricing nodes out there where there's different generators connected to the grid, but for market-based transactions for forward procurement from just, you know, system energy type stuff, the grid is really broken up into two chunks largely. It's NP15, which is North Path 15 and South Path 15. You are in South Path 15. It's kind of roughly SP is Edison's territory for the most part. NP15 is PG&E. That's not exactly right, but it's approximately close. Path 15 is kind of about where Diablo Canyon kind of intersects in the state, if you just kind of drew a line across there. So the screen capture there on the left is just, that's just a screen capture from ICE at a particular point in time. When we go out and procure electricity using these standard energy products for fixed price energy, the peak period covers 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and then the off-peak period is all the other hours of the year. Those definitions are different from retail definitions of peak and off-peak electricity. The market tends to trade in monthly blocks, quarterly blocks, and annual blocks. One of the other key pieces of our strategy is proposing to use the standard energy products because they're liquid, they're the most cost competitive, most cost effective. And then what we do is, and the standard block is a 25 megawatt block of time, so that's what's represented by the columns. Your load obviously doesn't occur in blocks. The load is represented by the red squiggly line on there. What we do, is use the block products to manage the price risk, to bring that price certainty, and then use the CAISO market for the shaping. So some hours you end up being a little bit long, some hours you end up being a little bit short, but on average we would buy enough energy to meet your load requirements, but use the CAISO market for shaping. The alternative is to actually go out and contract for supplies that deliver shape to that load. But what our experience has been is that the cost of those getting that certainty is prohibitive. It's more expensive than just doing it yourself in the marketplace.
Jeff, is this all done with a computer program?
The load forecasting, we do have automated models that that'll forecast the load, based off of historical data and temperatures, and then we put in the load we layer in the blocks to meet the load forecast. So we've got tools that are doing it, but still it takes people intervening to do it. So what our plan is, so right now we're looking at 2018 and 2019 predominantly. Here in the next few weeks, our plan is to go procure all the energy and renewable energy and carbon-free requirements once the lockbox is all set up and established through the balance of the year. Per your agreement with Southern California Edison and under the Option A waiver, we won't actually procure resource adequacy capacity. You'll compensate Edison for it, but you won't actually be out procuring. The 2019 procurement, what we're planning to do is that somewhere in the 40 to 45% of your 2019 requirements, we will actually go out and hedge that in October. And that's a function of how the power charge indifference adjustment or the exit fee is set. And that's a whole other topic for another day. But the real quick result is that financially, until that PCIA rate is set for the upcoming year, you're actually hedged by Edison's portfolio to the extent that they've got fixed price energy contracts in place. And it's not till the month of October when the brown energy component of that is set that you become unhedged for that portion. So that's what drives the 40 to 45%. The balance of that, so then that leaves you 55 to 60% that's still out there. What we're planning to do is roughly half of that, go ahead and procure that at the same time we go out and do the 2018 procurement, and then procure the remainder of that either in late 2018 or even early 2019, just trying to create a diversified portfolio, not going out and doing everything at a single point in time, kind of just, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket, dollar cost average type of a strategy. Resource adequacy for 2019, we'll procure that in the fall of 2018. The 2019 resource adequacy planning process will actually start next week. On the 20th, we'll submit a load forecast for next year, or you'll submit a load forecast for next year. That'll be trued up in August, and then shortly after that, we'll get the 2019 RA requirements, so we'll go out and procure that. And then also, too, the renewable and the carbon-free supply, we'll look to procure that for 2019 in late 2018. And we may find when we're out procuring for this year, if we see some attractive prices, we might go ahead and lock in some of that as well for 2019. So I know that's a lot of
information. But
on the RA for 20, well, actually, we're going to be giving them RA information in April.
Right.
Obviously, we won't be operational in April. So.
Right.
Are we basing that on our 10% of opt-out, or...
Yeah, well, it's a great question. So, yeah, the first load forecast that gets submitted in April will be based off of the 10%. Then we will have, and I forget when, but there's another forecast that will be due in August.
Yeah.
And so at that point, we still won't have perfect information, but we'll have some fine-tuning.
Pretty
so,
early.
Yeah, so we may fine-tune that. The intent, though, I guess... So we'll make best efforts. The thing, and actually I confirmed this with one of my colleagues that's our RA expert. I can't say that. The intent behind RA is, and the forecast is all good faith, best efforts.
Mm-hmm.
There's not any punitive aspects, if you will. We put in 10% and find out it's 5 or find out it's 15. There's no punitive aspect. As long as it's good faith, reasonable, you do have to explain your methodology, what the assumption was. You know, so we'll say it's 10% and, you know, based off of experience, you know, other CCA experience or to the extent we can fine tune it.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
This is just a graphical representation of what I just said. So these are the vertical axes there is your energy requirements and average megawatts, which is just taking the total megawatt hours over the course of the month and dividing by the number of hours. The blue line represents the heavy load, or blue column, excuse me, represents the heavy load hours or on-peak period. Light load hours is reflected by the red, so you can see those volumes. But again, our intent will be to go out and procure to those volumes. And generally what our plan is we like to try to transact when there's a good liquid market, when there's a lot of price, what we refer to as price discovery. So going back, and I know this one chart was really... You can't see that, but what we like to see when we transact is a good liquid market, good bids and offers out there and activity going on. And we'll try to give folks a heads up, hey, it looks like we're going to be buying for DCE, you know, here in the next day or two kind of a thing, give them a sense of the volumes and what those will be, and create kind of a little, not auction, but a little
sense
market
of interest.
Sense of interest in it. And try to, you know, build up and get them excited about it, and then give them a time and say, hey, you know, we're going to be live at, you know, 10 a.m. on next Wednesday, or, you know, whatever the time period is, and get them to bid to those, and then we just look to get the best deals. And again, the reason we like to have the liquid markets is because we can look on ICE. You know, it's very much analogous. If somebody wants to buy stock from you or whatever, and you know what the current rate is, you know, on the stock exchange or whatever, it's easier to set the price on those types of things. So let me pause there, because the rest of this is going to get into post 2019. That's really the plans for this year.
Any questions on?
One of the gentlemen who catches my ear mostly on the CCA issue. Speaks to me a lot about unforeseen things that we can't project by a computer model and weather. How are those? So say you have a really abnormal couple weeks in March.
Mm-hmm.
You go to those short-term markets. How much does that really affect your overall annual budget? Are those just kind of minor blips in the 12-month operating budget, or do they have a, you know, kind of a negative? How worried should you be about those? Obviously, you can't predict them, but what kind of impact do you see with that kind of?
Yeah, I don't know if John or Marty could give you a specific number impact on what those can be, but they can be significant, and we do, you know, watch those. And typically, I would say during, you know, they also, I mean, you can have some random
bizarre event at any point in time.
Absolutely.
But they're more common in, like, the summertime, you know, especially when, well, I guess it depends on what you're, you know, looking at. If you're looking at a potential negative price event, it could be in the spring, you know, when you got lots of hydroelectric generation going, you got solar, summer loads aren't really on. But, you know, the type of event we're talking about here most typically happens in a summer month. And so, you know, what our goal is like I said, is really to have a portfolio of contracts, a diversified portfolio, not having all your eggs in one basket. And I think it is prudent to leave some portion of your energy supply to a shorter-term market. But typically what we would do, or what we would recommend, is, you know, during those months, June, July, August, September, that are more prone to these types of events, maybe not taking anything into the actual spot market or cash, or, you know, leaving it to that day-ahead CAISO market and going ahead and buying energy on a month-ahead basis to take that off the table. So I don't know. So it is something definitely to be mindful of. I don't know the specific impact, but it does impact the hedging strategy, and would recommend.
Your opinion, though, is manageable.
Yes. And I mean, the flip side is, you know, if you go back and just look at everything on an expected value basis, forward prices tend to be more expensive than, you know, day-ahead prices, and day-ahead prices tend to be more expensive than real-time prices because you're building in a risk premium. But the flip side is, you know, those crazy events can be very expensive. And if it's an expensive day at the same day that your load is high, which is there's a very good chance that it is, because a lot of times it's, you know, a load-driven event, and then you lose a resource, you know, you want to minimize your exposure to them.
It would be, once you get up and running here more substantially, I'd be interested to hear your perspective on whether our region is more subject to volatility. I suspect it's not. Right. We already have our air conditioning on it when it's 110, and it gets to 120 compared to L.A., you know, struggling going from 80 to 100.
Yeah, our load should be pretty constant in those summer months. It's just on.
While that's true, it does seem to me that, for example, last summer was a pretty warm summer, and I think I saw probably a 10% higher usage because of the temperature. So it still gets to us.
But this is getting at, I showed on the one slide, you know, the risk management committee. This is one of the things that risk management committee will be charged with. So, you know, one of the things we'll do is we'll have a chart like this, only this is just load. We'll actually show whatever contracts have been put in place. So, you know, what net open position is there. So that's something you'll be looking at.
Maybe overbuying as part of your risk policy.
You very well could, and some entities do. The other thing we'll do is all the pro forma projections we've given you to date have been a snapshot in time. One of the things, though, that we're actually doing is we're already updating this with daily prices on it. So it doesn't typically change a whole lot day to day, but at any point in time, the intent is you'll be able to log on to a web portal. The risk management committee can log on to a web portal and can sit there and say, okay, you know, where's my pro forma at today, given where market prices are, given whatever open position, and starting to look at that. And then we'll come in with weather forecasts as well. Geez, you know, it looks like it's going to be a hot summer kind of a thing. Yeah. And we can also do some probabilistic type of analysis. Well, we'll say, okay, you know, right now on an expected basis, you're going to meet budget, but there's a 10% chance you may go past your budget by $1 million. And it's like, I don't want to do that, you know, kind of a thing. So then we can layer in a purchase. So anyway, that's the kind of decision-making that this risk management committee will be doing.
And just speaking to your point, it seems to me that the thing that's going to have more of a risk impact would be an event, for example, that significantly increases the price of gas, natural gas, at some point. Going back to the 1990s when things shot up. So that would have an impact on production and to translate out. This only relates to the degree that we're talking about pricing and purchase, because obviously geothermal was brought up. Geothermal right now is really behind the curve in terms of what they have to charge for energy, because they actually pay huge amounts of taxes, which solar and wind don't have to pay. And my understanding is there's So right now I think they're running like $80 to $90 dollars a megawatt hour. And it seems to me that there's a piece of legislation going through that would have some impact on reducing their tax costs. And if there is, I would think that we would want to support that in some way. So
we'll look into it.
Good. Thank you. Does that take us to item D, or do we have another?
Yeah, unless there are any, this was just the information only. And to put things in perspective, it does relate to discussion about CalCCA. The event that will have the biggest impact is
The
PCIA.
Yeah, no question.
A hot August will look like a small blip compared to what could occur in San Francisco. Even a large investment with CalCCA and advocating the San Francisco,
that's why we all
is the most significant thing we could be doing right now.
Yeah,
assuming they're effective.
Yes, well.
Yeah, I think for the purposes of what we
need. I think it's something to do.
Yeah.
Okay. That takes us to item 16, which is energy names.
Yeah, this is pretty straightforward. We brought this back to you because we failed the first go-around with a couple of names.
You're assuming this is still straightforward.
We've come up with a number of different options, and we do need to make a decision sooner rather than later so that we could put this out in our marketing material. We put some items for the basic product as well as the premium. On the basic, Smart Saver, Eco Smart, Desert Saver, and Basic. The premium, Clean 100, Carbon Free, Clean Spark, and Premium. Thoughts?
Yes, Jeffrey.
I think on the basic, the one I like best was Desert Saver because it has the savings part, but it has a little green feel because you have desert in it.
Good. That was mine, too.
Okay, and then I like Carbon Free for the other one, because it's very descriptive of what you're doing. If you're premium to me, sounds like, you know, expensive gas.
Expensive gas.
Yeah. So I sort of, those were the two that jumped out at me.
Those are my two as well, although I wanted something more than just Carbon Free.
Yeah.
But
I didn't love Carbon Free, but I thought it was the best of those groups.
Yeah.
Save the planet. Save the planet. Energy.
No, I don't have any objection. As long as it's not Clean Spark. I don't know.
And premium seemed to sound like it was more expensive.
Yeah. I mean, Carbon Free is pretty descriptive.
The problem that I have is, like, we're familiar, kinda, with all this, and Carbon Free, I don't know that it makes the case. Yeah, I'm just, the general public is going to go, well, what's that? You know. So I don't have a better idea. I don't have a problem if that's where we end up. I just...
Yeah, no, I didn't love it. That was the best.
Yeah, yeah.
When I looked at the first column, I like the word echo because I think most people understand that as being environmentally related. Uh-huh. So maybe echo carbon-free or echo 100% or something.
We had eco 100 was one of the choices that
echo
100%,
yeah. Okay.
Maybe Clean 100 makes the case more. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of just the general consumer
choice
who hasn't had the benefit of all these meetings and brilliance that exists in this room.
I presume we're trying to keep these as short as possible. So
maybe Carbon Free 100.
Or Charlie just said using the word choice. What about choice free? Is that...
I don't know what that means.
It
might be the opposite.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't want to give Bob Leather two voices, but what I like about carbon-free is its truth in advertising.
That's
what it is. And the more sophisticated green advocates might be quite fuzzy about a title that conceals the nature of this choice as not renewable, but instead carbon-free. So it strikes me better, given that we'll have lots of PR work to do, to just be really upfront about what this is.
Yeah.
before this appears, there'll be explanation. I mean, these are going to be like two buttons basically on the website. Eric is going to go into that. There'll be some explanatory information as well.
Okay.
So, guys, is that Desert Saver and carbon free?
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, I think the explanation is important though, for some folks.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need a
vote on that?
Why don't you do so? Just we have.
Well, let's do a vote on that.
Sure. So moved.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. That will take us to community engagement and outreach. Erica.
Chairman, members of the board, thank you. This has come up a few times, so I'll kind of go through what we are working on with our community outreach teams. There are two teams that were hired as part of the contractors. We have Green Ideals and Burke Ricks, which is the local firm. We've been working with them. In fact, we have a phone call with them every week, and we talk to them daily almost as we're working through. So a little recap of what you're aware of so far. As part of our efforts to establish DCE within the community, the board did approve the logo, and we talked about that in December. We have shown you the website, which is live now. It's a one-page website. It is not interactive yet, but it is a one-page What is DCE type webpage that is available. And we have established ourselves on social media in terms of our account, but we have not done any big pushing quite yet. So here's what's coming next. I want to first talk about what we're doing behind the scenes, and that is developing outreach strategies and outreach materials. And I will pass along. This is a look at what the website is in development right now. You will see, I'm going to pass this down. This is a draft of kind of the homepage that you would see. It's very similar to the page that exists now. The top photo rotates in its current design with different sayings that we feel establishes why DCE is important: lower rates, cleaner electricity, and community control. You'll see them at the top of the page as well. There's a how it works explanation. Those gray buttons will be filled in with some product logos that you just approved that will take you to the pages that exist for further information about both of those products. There's a map explaining our boundaries, and we are really trying to drive home choice. So rather than just say you're automatically enrolled, we, you know, kind of playing off this, do you have to apply? And, you know, the idea is that you do have a choice to, you can opt up or opt out, as well as just a choice in general. This full website is in development, and there are all sorts of interactive aspects about it. We will have a video that is in production now, and this will all go live, is currently scheduled to go live on June 1st with our website. And our goal is that in the next month, before June 1st, you will start to see us in a very strategic way out in the community, community stakeholders, key groups, chambers of commerce, major stakeholders, major organizations within the valley. We've already been doing that, but we'll be doing that on a broader level, but still in a very strategic way, targeted to the three cities that are involved. We are in the process of developing a brochure, a handout, so there'll be all sorts of informational materials that'll be left when we are going there. And the goal is to be out in the community in a broader sense before June 4th, which is when the first enrollment letters will go out. Based on the August 1st launch date enrollment, there are two enrollment letters that will go out beforehand. That's on June 4th and June 29th, and then there are two enrollment letters that will go out afterwards. We are in the development also of our enrollment letters. As you can imagine, we're doing a lot of copy editing on our end. So I brought you a couple of copies of what other enrollment letters look like. Of what enrollment letters have looked like in other communities. Another one. The second one from Redwood is actually a design style that we're looking at. It's a trifold that would be more like this rather than a letter that you would receive. We're also looking at more of a postcard style. We want to, you'll see throughout, I realize I just handed out a lot, but you'll see the tone that we're really trying to set is conversational, very, community oriented. type. So after the enrollment letters go out, we will continue our engagement. We'll continue to be out in the community. We'll start seeing, if you live in the cities that DCE covers, you'll most likely start seeing a lot of social media presence. We'll be doing that in a very targeted fashion, and that will all lead up to the August 1st launch. The reason we wanted to present this today is there are a number of things that we will need to purchase before we can do this, particularly postage and mailers. The printing costs and postage has been calculated, and we also are in the process of doing an informational video production. Those all come with some upfront costs. So as part of that, to cover mostly the printing and postage, we are asking and recommending the authorization to sign the agreements necessary up to $160,000 to cover the costs associated with those efforts.
Thanks, Erica. Additional bit of insight, or hopefully insight, is we could spend a lot of money on a media campaign here, and we could do so through television and radio and billboards. Keep in mind, of course, with three cities, we could create more confusion in the marketplace given IID, Rancho Mirage, Desert Hot Springs, and everything else. So our intent is to spend your scarce and their scarce dollars in very focused ways within your three cities. So it's unlikely you're going to see and hear stuff that's broadcast valley-wide. Yeah. And to that point, one of the things we will address is... And as board members, you ought to know Rancho Mirage is up and running. And they have offered their customers a 5% discount on the basic. I think the customers assume that's 5% off their bill. We think it's 5% off
their electricity.
Yeah. And we're going to be very clear that when we're talking about 3%, it's not 3% off the entire bill. Their premium, I do think they call it premium, is... on top is more expensive than the Edison rate. And so just when you're out, if you've been asked those questions, it will have certainly information on our website and other places. But I do believe for the 1 or 2 or hopefully 3%, including Kim, of course, that sign up to the carbon-free, offering that at Edison's rate, I think is going to give us a little bump in the sign-up rates, frankly. And I sure hope it does. And one of the things I'd asked Katie and Jeff to help us with for your perspective and kind of going to the point of why are we doing this, you all prepared climate action plans in your cities. I'll bet you just the little decisions you've made as a board already will be the most significant thing you do for climate action plans and achieving those goals in the next year. Just with a change of policy from 35% to or 29% to 35% is a huge difference, and 100% carbon-free is obviously a big difference too, because the take-up rate is not very significant. So we'll have some of that data for you so that you can answer the questions that come out in your communities. Any questions for Erica? And you do have a staff recommendation.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm sure that there are respective cities will want to... communicate this to our respective residents. So I assume that our PIOs can get information for, like, we have an article on our Brightside, our monthly newsletter, and so forth. We'd want to have a place where we can click on our city's website.
So I usually write down more detailed notes before the presentation, so thank you for bringing it up. We talked about this earlier today. In fact, we've talked about developing something that you can easily put on city websites as well. Katie has already reached out to all of your cities to talk to staff, and we'll be setting up a call. We wanted to wait till after today's meeting when we knew better about the rate structure and the product names before we actually had the call, but to talk about... very community-oriented outreach and maximizing what's already existing in City Hall. So we're definitely working with David, Amy, and Chris already.
Yeah, we just have this humongous lead time to get anything into our monthly newsletter.
Yes.
And amazingly, many of our residents actually read it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because we thought, why do we need something in print? But they read it. So we just need to if we're going to be coming out with information about the same time this is rolling out, we need to do that sooner rather than later.
And that's very much appreciate the point.
David...
He's on it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then in terms of talking points, you know, I can see where there's going to be some discussion about, well, you know, Rancho Mirage did it right, joining another one. Why did you form your own? And I think emphasizing that this is not just about a very modest savings, although maybe their residents need that saving more than our residents do. I'm saying. This is maybe a little subtlety there. You know, but it's as much about promoting a choice for greener energy, right? And so to the extent that we can have data that's impactful, like if we assume that, you know, 60% of our residents go 100% carbon free, what good are we doing to the planet? You know, what does that really mean? So something like that that's impactful,
yep,
as part of some talking points, because I think many of us are out in the community, and if you can assemble, you know, 6, 8, 10 talking points,
we'll do that.
Impactful. That'd be really useful.
Those will probably be. We'll take care of that. And I do want to remind ourselves that the difference in rates this year may be a little bit different between us and Lancaster, in large part because of the 2018 RA requirement. They got in under the gun prior to this latest decision by the PUC. Sure. So we have some additional costs this year that they didn't have to bear. We'll see what the rates look like next year, just as a reminder, and it could be a part of the talking points in detail, but an important one.
Good.
They've, you know, they built some of their own solar that they're using as well. But, you know, again, I think one of the other key issues is local control. The reality is that Rancho Mirage has gone with Lancaster, and they're really under Lancaster's control. Mm-hmm. They really don't have local control. Mm-hmm.
You have a staff recommendation before?
Before we get to that, yes. One other point, Erica, which is on Facebook. We now know from the Zuckerberg's testimony in Congress that you can literally focus in on an individual from a Facebook perspective for ads.
Yes.
And I'm assuming we're going to be using social media for that.
We are, actually, yes. And there are ways to, you know, to look at data versus zip code or IP address. And our team is still finalizing a strategy on how it wants to go about that. But to Tom's point, in terms of what, you know, targeting our resources, we feel that using social media or outlet, you know, to target, you know, we do that with CVAG's done that with other, you know, if you have an event in a market, you would market within X amount of miles of that city, et cetera. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, a quick aside to your point about Zuckerberg's point. 3 months ago, I was contacted by a public outreach consultant who pointed out this ability to target individuals, and it was very interesting. In an hour, I had an ad from this company show up on my Facebook page, so it's it can be done.
Charlie mentioned that we should probably target the cultivators, at least cannabis cultivators in the city, given the number that we have at this point, since they're going to be heavy
energy. They're big power users.
Absolutely. We will add them to the list of stakeholders.
We have had some outreach with CVCAN, with Jason and that group, so we'll follow up on that.
Can highlight the ones that go 100% carbon-free on the websites.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we have a motion on the authorization?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
You know what, on that last point, Mr. Chairman, thinking you all have interactions with those cannabis growers as well, encouraging them to do the right thing from a city hall perspective could be very useful.
I'm actually at the Cannabis Film Festival.
So we've got a Jeff, what do we call it, big user group, or the
key account.
Oh, the key account, big user group. Yeah,
cannabis
key account program.
When we add those, we may even reach out to you as board members and community liaison, let you know when we're reaching out to those groups and consumers, and to the degree you could be helpful with pushing. Yeah, our 100% product.
Yeah.
We don't have any on that yet, but we will.
I'm going to sign up. Announcements. Our next meeting is May 21st at 2:30 p.m. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.